And we are going to have, we're going to hear 342 first, then 183, then 404 at 4 o'clock. And we will hopefully moving 342. I believe we may move 183. We will not be moving 404 today, but we're going to have a nice conversation about it. Just to let everybody know, I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 342A.
So, Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 342A allows a nurse or an employee of the Department of Safety, Quality Safety Standards and Training, who is retired under the first.
Would you please all shut your phones, pagers, anything off, please? Thank
you, Mr. Chair. It allows a nurse or an employee of the DPSST who is retired under the Public Employees Retirement System to be employed full-time by a public employer as a nursing instructor or a department instructor without any loss of retirement benefits, and establishes a sunset of January 2, 2016. Committee members, you have in your bill packet a -A4 amendment, which establishes that nursing instructors or DPSST training instructors that are covered under the measure are considered as public employees as part of the current collective bargaining unit and are subject to collective bargaining agreements. And the measure also establishes that the positions that are created under this measure are to be recruited, selected, and promoted open and competitive.
And I just misspoke. We're hearing this bill, then 404, then 183 at 4 o'clock. Senator Montesantis.
Thank you, Chair, and members of the committee. I'm delighted to be here on this beautiful, I think we're so holed up inside, day in May. I'm Senator Lori Montes Anderson from the Gresham Troutdale Village Fairview area, and I'm delighted to come forward with Senate Bill 342. And you just heard the explanation, and I want you to know that with the department, and you've also actually heard a bill very similar to this that included all nurses, but that was sent to Ways and Means. I want to be upfront right from the beginning. We have the fiscal analysis, and do you have the fiscal analysis in your packet? Because the fiscal analysis is no expenditure impact for Senate Bill 342 and notice of no revenue impact on Senate Bill 342. And so we have let the Speaker's office know that, and I think that permission actually will come from the Speaker's office.
Senator, we do have it in our packet that was passed out today.
It was?
Yes, ma'am.
That there's no revenue impact. Okay.
That's correct.
We have required a lot more training now in the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, and we're at a point now where we're getting so many who do the training yet are at retirement age, and this would at least give the opportunity for DPST to use their experienced people if they have retired to be able to come back and teach full-time, especially with the increased training that we have provided for our police force. And the same goes for our nursing community. There is about 23% of the current full-time faculty positions that will be able to retire within 5 years. This bill will allow those instructors that are in the community colleges and at OHSU, who are really the only ones under the PERS system, to be able to teach more than the 1039 number of hours that we are limiting our PERS retirees to. Again, with so many people retiring and with the goal of increasing the healthcare workforce in the community colleges and OHSU have really done a fantastic job in some cases doubling the enrollment and graduation rate at their respective nursing schools. And we do have a critical nursing workforce shortage. And I know that this bill at least narrows it to just keep it to those who train our police force and do the training for our nursing. And I'll just leave it at that because I know you have a full agenda.
Thank you. Any questions to the good senator? Representative Byrd?
Probably not for the senator, but at somebody who's going to come along and remind me of what the requirements are for retirement under PERS for these folks. I have a little bit of a concern, just so you know where I'm going with this, that people in these positions will just say, why keep working just retire and double dip, if you will.
Well, on that right there, Representative, there's no such thing as double dipping. When you retire, you've got a benefit that you've earned, and after that, you can go choose to do whatever you want.
Yeah, and many of them are going to the non-PERS. Many of the nurses,
Mr. Chip, I could explain my concern.
Mm-hmm.
My concern is that there is absolutely no incentive here to stay, you know, and work longer. This is a disincentive for people to stay at jobs they are trained and ready to go to. It actually encourages people to leave them. That is my concern.
And Representative, I'm confident your concerns will be reflected in whatever way you vote.
Yes, and I understand your concerns. Thank you, Representative Berger, for those comments. At this point in time, usually those who are ready to retire, as I am at that age also, we want to retire. And then after a couple of years, you say, okay, it would be nice to get back into the force. And if you're really needed, what nurses have done is gone to other institutions so they don't have to meet that 1039. So we are actually losing a valuable resource. There may be some nurses, faculty that would do that, and I would have to have those nursing faculty say, oh yes, I'll retire early. I'm not sure that many of them would want to give up their health insurance benefits at this point in time. So they would, because when you retire, you're losing your health insurance benefit. Yes, you'll get your retirement benefit, but health insurance is extremely...
You have to pay for it.
Yeah, you have to pay, and like I am, I'm paying almost $400 a month for my health insurance.
Thank you. Any more questions of Senator Lana Sanderson? Thank you, Senator. I know you're busy.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Glashman, would you like to come up and explain that a little bit further, please?
Mr. Chair, I can see that you saw my leaning forward and anxiety. Brian DeLeishman, representing the Oregon Nurses Association. Let me first state that there are three different versions of PERS-related bills as it relates to nurses or nurse educators in the process. A House bill came out of the Health Care Committee and is now in Ways and Means. Senate Bill 4, which is the nursing shortage bill, and in fact is moving along the process, and it has a slightly different approach than this bill. It has a declared nursing shortage. So as long as there's a declared nursing shortage, then, in fact, they have the ability to exceed the 1040 rule. And then this bill has a sunset on it. So in relationship to Senator or Representative Berger, I gave you a promotion today.
Maybe.
Whoa.
A demotion, thank you. Sorry, Senator.
I've been there, done it. I know.
Uh-oh. I've really stuck my foot in it now. Let me have a couple of comments. One is... one of the situations that you have in nursing education is not an actual professor, let's say at the Health Sciences University or a community college that has been there for a long period of time, decides to retire and then come back and exceed the 1040 rule. What you often have is a master's prepared public health nurse who may be in a clinical situation with the counties or whatever, or a nurse practitioner who retires and then says, I have some clinical expertise that I could, in fact, then go and teach at a community college or at the Health Science University. And currently, there's a disincentive for them to do that under the way that we structure it now, other than then for them to not technically retire and then go to work over here. They currently have the ability, however, as a PERS retiree, to go to the Linfield Good Sam School of Nursing and teach nursing. They could go to the University of Portland program and teach. There's no disincentive because it's a non-PERS employer that's hiring them. So what we've set up is a situation in which there's a disincentive for nurses who have the expertise and have had a long history in the public sector as far as PERS for going to work as a public sector nurse instructor. And that's what this bill is trying to get at, is let's take it down that barrier along those lines. And the last comment that I would give to you is that, and it's a little far afield, but it's not fully far afield, is that the faculty salaries for nurse educators in the state is so abysmal that what you have is a clinician with a master's, a nurse practitioner, could make $80,000 to $90,000 continuing to work. But as a faculty member, you may only make $50,000. So these folks, in fact, are on the verge of volunteering by coming back. They're going to continue to draw their retirement salary, but they're going to come back at a reduced, vastly reduced salary by coming to back to work as a nursing faculty member.
Thank you. We got to get moving on. Thank you, Mr. Glashman. I'm going to call Eric Gablix, Kevin Campbell, and Mary Botkin, please.
Thank you, Chair Schaffler, members of the committee. I'll be very brief. My name is Kevin Campbell. I'm with the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police, supportive of this bill. As you know, with the new Public Safety Academy, which all Oregon law enforcement officers are trained in their basic training now, including Oregon State Police, we have a kind of a single provider of all our important 16 weeks of public safety training. This is training that's become more and more complex. Because it's 16 weeks of training and because DPSST is trying to juggle some full-time positions, volunteers out of police agencies, and some of these folks that fall under the category of PERS retirees, it's a difficult struggle. And some of our brightest trainers out at DPSST are retired. They have unique skill abilities and have a unique contribution to make. We'd like to be able to see them continue to do their work without being pulled when they reach the hourly limit. It's already been mentioned that we do have a sunset on both provisions of this new law. That's because we do believe the legislature should have a chance to review this again just to make sure that it's actually operating the way you intend it to. But we believe it's very important for the Department of Public Safety standards and training. We hope you'll be able to support the bill.
We can either take advantage of these people's skills, experience, and knowledge, or we cannot. Mr. Gablix, open, saying your name right.
That's okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Eric Gablix, Deputy Director of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. I'll keep my comments short as well. As Kevin mentioned, we really are losing our varsity team. We have a very thin JV team that's still learning their skills, and we have a very large freshman team of new officers out on the streets. We do have challenges recruiting officers from metro-sized agencies because of our compensation. We realize that, and we're working through the process with our bargaining unit to see if we can remedy that. But we're looking to retain those people that have that knowledge, skill, and ability in the state so they don't have to retire, or I'm sorry, don't have to give up training at the academy once they do retire. We have had a number of discussions with our bargaining, which is actually we have a great relationship with them. This bill would allow us to consider PERS retirees in our recruitment process. It doesn't mean that we will hire them. It just lets us open up that pool right now, as we have for people from other states to come to Oregon that want to continue to provide service in public safety. And the other thing is that if we do hire these people to work for us full-time, they would be covered under the collective bargaining agreement with our local. So we think we have a pretty good solution to some of these issues that allow us to really retain this knowledge and ability in Oregon, where we've actually invested quite a bit to train these people here.
Thank you. Mary?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Mary Botkin. I'm with the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. And I just passed out copies of an amendment that we proposed. It's the A4s, and I'm here to say never mind. We have had, as Eric said, we've had some ongoing discussions with both he and Director Minnis, and we are comfortable that at this point there will be no effort to circumvent our collective bargaining agreement or the unit, and that all the trainer positions will be open for competitive bids so that folks who are already working there will be given the opportunity to move into other training opportunities if they want to and if they're qualified to do so. The sunset makes us a little more comfortable. We do not want to be the union that represents, you know, a whole bunch of part-time trainers. We think that the department eventually ought to have a good, fully staffed training center utilizing part-time or temporary trainers as needed for specialty courses. That is not the case right now. We just simply cannot recruit and retain enough trainers to get the job done. So we're willing to work with the department and with the other parties to make sure that the training is accomplished in a timely manner, and then we'll come back and revisit it. And trust me, if there's a problem, we'll see you in February.
Any questions of this nice panel? The chair is open to questions and comments and diverse opinions.
You want me to comment for something?
I just wanted to square that away today.
What do you want me to comment on?
Okay. All right. Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Would anyone else like to testify on Senate Bill 342A today? All right. Seeing no one, I'm going to... I'm just going to close the public hearing on this bill. We may return to it before the day is over.
Excellent, Mr. Chair. The Speaker's office requested a holdover until Wednesday so we can look at the bill. So
we will not be doing any further action on that then. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 183A.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 183A extends the Rural Medical Professional Liability Reinsurance Program that's currently administered by SAFE through 2011. The measure allows nurse practitioners to qualify for the program, clarifies the definition of a rural practice for purposes of qualifying for the program. The measure also requires physicians who receive the subsidy to serve a representative percentage of Medicaid and Medicare patients. And there's an emergency clause in the measure effective on passage. You have in front of you six different amendments. There's synopsis on four of the amendments on the staff measure summary. And there is a hand-engrossed summary of the -A9 amendment.
Thank you. I'm going to call Corey Streisinger at DCBS first, and we will get representative.
Yes.
I got 9, 10, 11, and 12. I don't have a 14, I don't think.
16,
I
have a 9.
9, 10, 11, 12.
We're going to get it right now.
Oh, here's a 15.
15, 11.
And 14.
Whenever you're ready.
Chair, for the record, I'm Corey Streisinger, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here today to talk about Senate Bill 183, which represents an extension and restructuring of the program that the legislature established in 2003 to assist rural doctors with the costs of their medical malpractice insurance premiums. The goal of the program was and still is to provide access to health care for rural Oregonians, and particularly with an emphasis on obstetrics and primary care. The bill was, I think, by all accounts, successful in achieving its goals, but there was also some feeling that it could use some fine-tuning. One of the things that you have in front of you or is being passed out is a report that we did, as required by the original 2003 legislation, on the progress of the program. It looks like this, and you should see it in front of you. Basically, over 1,000 doctors in rural Oregon are receiving assistance under this program. It provides subsidy of malpractice insurance premiums at the level of 80% for those practicing obstetrics, 60% for those practicing family practice whose practice includes obstetrics, and 40% for all other doctors. And OHSU and the Office of Rural Health did quite a bit of analysis of the program. You'll see some of the results in the report that we've handed out about numbers of doctors participating in what specialties, in what counties, and how much reimbursement they've received. And in addition, OHSU did a fairly extensive survey of doctors and found that this was a very important tool in retaining doctors in rural Oregon. And in fact, their conclusion is that without this program, many doctors in rural Oregon would seriously consider leaving their practice. Now, there was the original funding source for this program. We set aside up to $40 million from a source actually of premium assessments paid for the workers' compensation program, which I can go into in more detail if you would like. The original intent was to fund the program for 4 years with that amount of money. During that initial four-year period, in fact, the program cost was only $21 million. So what we are proposing in Senate Bill 183 is to extend the program for an additional 4 years, but within that original funding source, and use the dollars in a way that aims most directly at serving the needs of rural Oregon. There was a work group on the Senate side to look at how best to reshape the program and reprioritize the program. Senator Bates was heavily involved in that work group. Representative Comp, who is here, Representative Maurer. And basically, the bill in front of you represents the results of that work group, and I'd like to briefly walk through what the changes are that are being recommended as a result of that work group's product. First of all, there are some modifications to the geographic...
How long is it going to take you?
I can take anywhere from 30 seconds to longer.
I have Representative Kopp and Senator Bates here, and they have to go back to work, so I don't know how you...
Happy to step aside or to stay up here with them or however you'd like
to. Yeah, why don't you stay right with our... Representative, would you come on up here and give us your... And Senator Bates?
I think Senator Bates should get the...
Whenever you're ready, too. I know you all are busy, and I want to get you going, and then Corey can go back to the nuts and bolts.
Senator, you
want
to start?
Please, thank you. And it's the chair's fault. I got screwed up on my order here, and I opened this up, and that's why we're here before 4 o'clock. But everybody's in the room now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Senator Alan Bates. I'm from District 3 in Southern Oregon, and I'm also a practicing physician down there. And I needed the exercise anyway, Mr. Chair, and so I ran down some steps and ran down the hall, and that's probably good for me. I'll kind of start at the beginning real quick on this bill and kind of tell you what started out at, and I think Corey's probably told you a great deal about it already, and we've got some little fixes that we have to do to make this right, because we got some Scribner's errors in here and that we didn't pick up on in the Senate side. Sorry. But that's what we keep the House ready for you. You pick us up, okay?
Yeah, okay.
last summer in, I've told this story before, last summer in Medford was a very warm summer, many days over 100 degrees. I'm sure the vice chair is aware of that. It was especially warm summer for me. The Oregonian made it so. And it was over these issues that this bill addresses. The bill initially had been set up to, not this bill, but the program initially had been set up to take care of a very serious problem in Oregon. That was the loss of primary care, obstetrical care, and some specialty care in rural parts of Oregon, both by nurse practitioners and by physicians. The governor's office brought forward a very innovative program that, in fact, worked extremely well. It's done a great job of stemming the loss of those physicians and nurse practitioners. Actually recovered a few and had a few more come back in. And basically, what the bill or the program did was gave a supplement against the medical malpractice cost, the premium paid by physicians in certain specialties. In obstetrics, it was up to 60%, in primary care, 40%, and declining issues, which you can read in the bill. The net effect was to do exactly what we wanted. Unfortunately, when the bill was written initially in the previous session, it included inadvertently an area of the state which is not truly rural. It fit one category of rural as defined by the federal government, but not another. An area, unfortunately for me, was Ashland, Oregon. And I think we're all aware of that, and I really don't want to go back through it. Okay? I was accused of cutting deals from my friends, which I did not do. In fact, I didn't receive a penny of this practice in Medford. So, anyway, moving on. What we have found out as we went through this was that, as I said, the bill worked well. The previous bill worked well. We had several work groups get together over a period of 6 to 8 weeks. Often meeting at 6 or 7.
It was longer than that.
Yes.
And earlier than that.
Luckily, a member of your side of the building brought donuts and kept us going every morning. We often would start at 6 or 7 to get this resolved with the right people in the room. You can cut and splice and dice what rural is a dozen different ways, as I found out, and the federal government does. But we end up using one form of the federal government's definition of rural, which worked well for us. And it really does define the rural areas of the state. It's all of the coast, all of eastern Oregon, with the exception of Bend, and parts of the I-5 corridor, which really are rural, believe it or not. And they're rural from the point of view of the mixture of patients there. A high degree of Medicare, a high degree of Medicaid, which are very low-pay patients, a high degree of uninsured, and a very low percentage of commercial patients. That's what you see in rural Oregon. Now, these are difficult places to maintain physicians in. So areas like Grants Pass, Roseburg, Myrtle Creek, Rouche, Shady Cove are in. Places like Medford and Ashland are out, and rightfully so. So we first had to settle on a definition of what's rural. We got that done after a huge amount of work. And then we had to make sure that the amount of money we had left in the program would last for 4 years. And we did that by keeping the obstetrical situation kind of the way it was, primary care basically the way it was, and then a, we call a glide path, a rapid decrease for subspecialists and specialists as far as what we give them as a subsidy for their medical malpractice. We determined that the necessity for a subsidy for medical malpractice supplementation for subspecialists and specialists was not as acute. It was helpful, but not as acute as it was for primary care because of the difference in reimbursement rates for those specialties versus primary care. So that was the essence of what we did. We also discovered as we went along that surprisingly there was one group in action that it should be included in this. You'll see that as in the A engrossed version. We found out there was a group of primary care physicians there doing obstetrics primarily for a clinic called La Clinica, which is very low income individuals, primary Latinos, and they have a program where they deliver them in Ashland. And when we checked with the Medford community of physicians and asked them, could you accept these extra 300 to 400 deliveries every year? They said, we don't have the capacity for that right now. We don't want this program to go away in Ashland. So we have the bill written in a way that includes just those people doing this particular job in Ashland. I think that probably covers the basics of the bill for you. We've also found, unfortunately, some Scribner's errors that occurred in this concerning the language around what we meant to say is as far as who you're taking as patients. We believe that if you're in a rural area as designated by this bill, that your practice has to be open to Medicare and Medicaid up to the level of the percentage that is equal to what your percentage in your county is. So in other words, if you're getting the subsidy, you're taking all comers for all intents and purposes up to the same level as the percentage of the county. The bill actually says that you will, as it is right now, actually says you will absolutely be certain that your practice has that percentage. Well, that's impossible to do. If you're an obstetrician or a pediatrician, you can't get that many Medicare people into your practice unless you decide that 65-year-olds are pediatric cases and 32-year-old ladies having babies are Medicare eligible. Ain't going to happen. So we're proposing language to go back to our original intent, which says you got to keep your practice open up to that level. To make things a little more difficult for you, you're probably getting more information you want right now. We have other issues in this bill that I really don't want to try to address in this bill. We've recently had several physicians in Eastern Oregon decide not to take Medicare patients anymore. That's a huge step for them. Medicare reimbursement in this state is the lowest in the nation. It's gotten so low that half the physicians in Portland, I'm told, don't take Medicare anymore. They just won't take them. And more physicians saying, I'm capping my practice in Medicare or I won't take Medicare. That's a separate issue from this bill. And we still think that the best language you can use is to ask that they be willing to take patients up to the percentage equal in their practice, equal to what's going on in their county as far as percentage of Medicare and Medicaid. So I think that's the basics of it. We do not have those amendments completed yet for you. We'll have those within probably a day or two and hope to have them back here for you for next week on Tuesday or Wednesday.
Would anyone have any questions for the Senator before he goes? I just wanted to say thank you. This is a very complex issue. The initial concept is a great idea. And I know I've known you since 2003, and I know you would never cut a deal. And I think the people of your district should be very grateful they have you here. And I hope someday this state gets to, in a very public way, express their gratitude for your service here in this
world. We're not going there, Dave.
I know. That's just an open statement. You can interpret it any way you want. Thank you, though.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, members of the committee. And I'll leave them. Qualified and capable hands of these two nice ladies.
Thank you. Representative?
Okay. Thank you, Chair Schaffler. For the record, my name is Representative Betty Comp, and I represent House District 22, which is North Salem, as well as communities of Woodburn, Jervis, and Brooks. I'm here to speak in support of Senate Bill 183A with amendments that are going to be coming, and which would extend and restructure our program to help rural doctors in meeting the costs of their malpractice insurance premiums. My interest in this bill is in providing access to health care for families throughout Oregon, and in particular in making sure that we keep primary care available for those OB patients and babies. primary care available in the rural parts of our state. I served on this work group that looked at this program from the Senate side with Senator Bates' leadership, and I'd like to add right here for the record, I don't know how many hours he worked with a subgroup within this group to figure out that definition of what's rural. We had all kinds of maps and all kinds of definitions, and he took an enormous amount of his time to make sure it was fair and equitable. We looked at how the program has been working. We discussed the many ways we could fine-tune it. The basic message we heard is that this program is a very important tool for keeping rural doctors, and without it, we would seriously consider losing their practices in Oregon. Sounds like good college professors. We all agreed that the program should be retained, but also that it could be improved to focus more closely on the areas of highest need. Corey has gone over some of that. So has Dr. Bates, Senator Bates. But three priorities we have, and I'll just go over them just real quickly. The highest priority is obstetricians and to family practitioners who practice includes obstetrics. I can't. Bleh. And the next highest primary care is primary care doctors. Under Senate Bill 183A, doctors and non-primary care specialties receive a lower reimbursement that declines over time. It also scales down the geographic reach of the program so that we can continue it for the full depth of the intended amount of another 4 years, and that we looked at the definitions of what rural is compared with the U.S. Census. I'm pretty excited about this. We'll probably have to have a few conflicts of interest stated when we get to this on the floor. We now include nurse practitioners, nurse midwives, and they are just a critical part of many healthcare organizations. We want to make sure we have the health care that we need to get our children started on the right foot and our people when we're doing this. And I know my first message that I received as a representative is, what are you going to do to make sure we don't lose our obstetricians in many, many parts of Oregon? And so when I was asked to join this work group, even though we did start at an unbelievably early time in the morning, it's been very rewarding. I've learned a lot, and it's an important step, and I urge your support.
Thank you, Representative. Any questions of the representative before we let her go back to work? Okay. Thank you for everything you did.
Thank you. And Corey's awesome.
Okay. Yes, she is. Thank you. Corey, okay, resume where you left off, please.
Thank you. And again, for the record, Corey Streisinger, Department of Consumer and Business Services. And Senator Bates and Representative Comp have already outlined a good portion of the purposes behind this bill. I'd like to just briefly go over in a little more technical detail what the specifics in the bill are. One of them that's been mentioned is the definition of rural, a subject that received quite a bit of attention. And if you want to actually see the map that reflects it, it is in this report that we handed out, and it's the first map, so it's on Appendix B, page 2. And the definition basically is the Office of Rural Health definition, which defines as rural all of Oregon that is more than 10 miles from a population center of 30,000 or more. So if you're within 10 miles of one of those population centers, you are not rural. But most of Oregon does qualify as rural. The change that we made in this bill, as Senator Bates mentioned, is to exclude the areas that are defined as urbanized under census definitions, and that is Ashland, Albany, and Independence, with the exception of the family practice doctors who include obstetrics in Ashland. So that was the resolution with respect to the what areas should be considered rural. With respect to the subsidy levels, the Senate Bill 183 continues the level for obstetricians at 80% of their malpractice insurance premium, with the up to the limit specified in the bill. 60% for family practitioners whose practice includes obstetrics. 40% for primary care doctors, and this is a change. Everybody else was at 40% in the original bill, so we divided that into two categories. 40% for primary care doctors, but capped at their premium level of 2007. And then for the specialists, non-primary care specialists, a declining percentage that would go from 35% in 2008 down to 15%
to the extent of available funds within that original funding source. And it may be that funds are not sufficient. So that group of specialists would their reimbursement would decline first if there aren't sufficient funds. We did include nurse practitioners, including nurse midwives, into the bill. They provide a lot of primary care in rural Oregon. We, as I think Senator Bates mentioned, the bill includes a requirement that doctors be open to serving Medicare and Medicaid patients. That was always the intent of the work group, and I agree with Senator Bates that the wording there probably needs to be improved, because currently it says you have to serve Medicare and Medicaid patients up to the equivalent percentage of the population in your county. And as has been mentioned, that's not realistic or possible in some cases. All we're asking is that in order to participate in this program, you have to be open. Your doors have to be open until your practice includes that percentage, at which point you can say, I've done my share. So that provision is in the bill, and I will point out, I will just add that particular provision is quite important to the governor, and he asked me to convey to you, because there's been some question about that, that yes, that is a provision that he thinks is important if we are providing a public subsidy. We know these doctors provide very valuable service to rural Oregon, but it's his view that there should be that access to health care for all of Oregonians in rural Oregon, regardless of income level and age. There was quite a bit of discussion about doctors who receive their malpractice insurance coverage through a hospital. And this program was originally designed to provide assistance to doctors who purchase their own malpractice insurance coverage. And that is still the primary thrust of the bill. There was discussion of a very narrow exception to that for doctors who buy their insurance through a hospital but reimburse the hospital. They're not hospital employees. They're individually named and priced. It's a very narrow exception. It is in the bill. It may not cover many doctors. It may not cover any doctors, frankly. We've gotten some feedback on that. But the general feeling was this is aimed at individual doctors, not at hospitals. It's a limited pool of funds, and that was the choice made in terms of prioritization. So that's the gist of the bill. In terms of the amendments, the A-9 amendments are technical changes that I wanted to mention to you. They fix a problem with the effective dates of the bill. The bill has an emergency clause because there's work that needs to be done, but the intent is for these changes to be effective starting in calendar year 2008. The program currently sunsets at the end of 2007. So the amendments in the A-9s are primarily intended to fix those date issues. There's one other change in the A-9s, and that involves in one place in the bill, it references a particular group of doctors as being entitled to benefits under this program. It's never been intended as an entitlement. So we've changed that to eligible, consistent with the rest of the bill. In terms of the technical fixes that Dr. Bates mentioned, there are actually two versions. Claudia Black and I were just consulting outside before you opened the hearing. The A-14s change that provision about Medicare and Medicaid to say rather than serving Medicare and Medicaid up to the population in the county, you have to maintain a practice open to serving. I think Claudia's amendments phrase it slightly differently, but with the same intent. I believe hers is willing to serve. That's fine, too. And then there will also be some amendments proposed that address the nurse practitioner's openness to serving Medicare and Medicaid patients as well. There again, I'm sorry about this. We've been in a hurry. Two versions of those, the A-15s, and I think you will see some other language, again, with the same intent there. So I'm happy to answer any questions. I know this is a lot of material, and you've got a busy schedule here.
Any questions for Ms. Streisinger? Oh, well, I'm sure we're all very clear on what's going on. Yes, Representative.
Yeah, I do. I have more amendments than were explained, but the A-9s were technical. And then the 10s, a couple of others add nurse practitioners language, and 10 and like 15. That is not in the original. It's just, no. Nurse practitioners are included in the original bill, so I don't know what those amendments do.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, nurse practitioners are included in the original bill. And I am not familiar with the dash A-10s, but at one point I was told that the dash A-10s were intended to add the obstetricians in, the nurse practitioners who do obstetrics in Ashland back into the bill, as we added the Ashland doctors, obstetric doctors, back into the bill. That would be fine with us, too. We all realize that obstetrics in Ashland is a special case, if you will. Okay. I believe that's the purpose of the A-10s.
Okay. I have to ask a question. Corey, this does take care of the plastic surgeon, doesn't it?
Mr. Vice Chair, yes, the plastic surgeon in Ashland would not qualify for this program
any
longer. That's
what the big stink was about.
And I believe we have actually given to you individually copies of an editorial and article from the Oregon expressing their appreciation for the work of the legislature in addressing some of the concerns that were raised and support for Senate Bill 183 in its current form.
Yes. Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Corey, for bringing this forward. I think sometimes when I get caught up in the discussions around plastic surgeons and exceptions, we also forget to mention that I remember this bill from the 2003 session, and I remember that there is a crying need out there for medical practice, the basic nature, and in the rural areas, and I have a file full of emails from folks who've been caught in this. So I applaud your work on this and the fact that we do have a need and we have a funding source and we have a good program, and with these some fixes, we're going to be right back where we need to be.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Representative Colby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Corey, underlying this program is something maybe not really addressed in this bill, but since your division handles oversight of insurance, is there anything in the insurance division's toolkit or I guess oversight that can identify what we can do about the high cost of medical liability insurance?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holby, that is a question that is a mile wide, and you'll get many, many different views of what the right answers there are. And there have been at least two interim task forces looking at that issue in the last 4 or 5 years, and a lot of work spent by this body. Because the issues are pretty polarized, not a lot of consensus. I will say that the medical malpractice liability insurance market has softened considerably over the past few years. I'm pleased to report that we were seeing, a number of years ago, very significant increases. Those have leveled off. We've actually seen some decreases, and we're very pleased with this. I won't tell you that it'll stay flat forever, but certainly the annual double-digit increases that we were seeing back at 2001, 2002, we are not seeing today.
Mile-wide question, I guess, deserves a mile-wide answer. Thank you.
That is true.
A nice, healthy dose of tort reform probably wouldn't hurt, but that's my opinion. Any further questions of our friend here? All right. Thank you, Corey. I'd like to, and don't go too far just in case.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Gallant, would you please come up here and help us with this?
Gallant.
But Scott, come on up here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm not going to read my testimony, which is the good news. The bad news is I'm going to do this off the cuff, and I want to point out some of the things that you're just about to be handed on rural practice, age of physicians, the percentage of patients that rural physicians accept under the Medicaid and Medicare program, their patient mix, et cetera. Because I think it's very important for you to know that. And the reason is this bill obviously is very, very important for patients to have access to medical services in rural areas of the state. The second reason is we clearly, I believe, have to find a permanent funding source to be able to recruit and retain physicians in rural Oregon primarily for a couple of reasons. Our physician population is aging. Many are over the age of 60, particularly in rural Oregon. And I can assure you that being able to recruit physicians to areas, rural areas, has become difficult and more difficult as time has gone on. And it will become more so because we have a national shortage of physicians who are being trained in the country. Just as a minor aside observation, if you don't mind, physicians obviously may practice anywhere in the country. Many other states have much higher reimbursement rates under Medicaid, Medicare, and commercially than we do in Oregon. And it's an international market. And so if you have a practice environment that is difficult and you have a low reimbursement rate, it is very difficult to recruit physicians to the state. We don't produce enough physicians at OHSU to replace physicians who are retiring. Everyone knows that, and we recruit the large majority of physicians who practice in Oregon from other areas of the country. So that aside, I thought it would be possibly helpful so that you would have an understanding of what physicians in Oregon, rural Oregon, actually do to go through a 2007 survey of physicians that was conducted by the Department of Human Resources, 07, so its most current data has not actually been released yet, so I'm assuming that I'll be fined or put in jail for utilizing this, but they're important statistics. At the top of the first colored sheet, it provides you with a differentiation of the physicians whose practices are closed to Medicare patients and those who either who limit or have open practices for all comers. For Eastern Oregon, Southern Oregon, Southwestern Oregon, and Northwestern Oregon, clearly I picked those because that's really rural Oregon. And in this instance, the lowest percentage of practices that either limit or are open is 85%. Southwest Oregon is 87%, either accept all Medicaid patients or accept some but limit them. For Medicaid, it's in the range of 85 to 90% by region. I've added these numbers up. They don't total. They're not going to total the same total I have. I simply subtracted the, for example, under Medicaid, the 10.2%, which is completely closed, and then you get the difference of most practices. The point is, are in fact already open or to Medicare and Medicaid eligibles. The two reasons for having practices limited should not be a stunner. It's primarily because of reimbursement for both Medicare and Medicaid. And the second most important reason is to balance the type of patients one sees, so one can cover the cost of a practice, overhead costs, and actually pay yourself something after doing that business. I'm sure you're also aware that under the Oregon Medicaid program, at a minimum, the Medicaid program pays physicians 38% less. And I think it's worse, as does a consultant of ours, 38% less in their costs of providing the service. Medicaid is 40% and getting worse. There's a 10% cut that will go into effect in 2008 unless Congress, again, for about the 18th time, appropriates money to stop that reduction for a year. You don't want me to go into that. Anyway, it's a declining revenue reimbursement rate under Medicare. There's a major need to significantly fix it, and it's a lot of bucks to do it. Payer mix is very important, which is what I mentioned before to you. And what I did in this chart was I wanted you to see for the same areas the kind of patient mix that rural physicians have, including essentially charity care. The top line, which is green, is the statewide average. And then you can clearly see what physicians do and the kind of patients that they see. I also provided you with the statewide analysis of the amount of charity care that physicians provide throughout the state, including rural Oregon. And I think it's fairly incredible. This is a monthly number. Physicians can offset that with some kind of deduction or anything, and I think that's obviously a very important part of any medical practice, and physicians do that. 69% of all obstetricians provide charity care, and interestingly, 66% of all general surgeons. And I put that in here for a particular reason. In a rural area, it is very critical to have primary care physicians. There's no question about it. It's imperative. But you also need general surgeons in order to do services that are absolutely life-saving. And there is, unfortunately, in Oregon, a shortage of general surgeons, and nationally the same problem. So that is a big deal for rural patients. And unfortunately, in the same survey, it also lists the percentage of physicians who are going to retire either within 2 years or within 0 to 5 years. And Northwest Oregon, for example, is really scary. 33% of those surveyed, and this was a statewide survey, exceedingly good numbers, very good data, 33% of Northwest Oregon physicians are planning to retire in the next 5 years. And the numbers in the other areas are really not much better. This is a very, very serious problem. This bill is very, very important. We most certainly agree and appreciate Corey's efforts to come to an agreement on language on willingness to serve Medicaid and Medicare patients. Physicians do that. In our view, we are looking forward to the committee getting this bill amended and moved out. But I can assure you, and I hope that we do this sooner rather than later, finding a stable funding source, or, God forbid, increasing reimbursement under Medicaid, really would be appreciated by those who are trying to serve these patients day in and day out, and they're literally on call almost 24 hours a day. So I appreciate, I hope, your support in moving this bill, but we will be back. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
No, thank you, Scott. And I think we can someday find a funding source, but the reimbursement, I mean, we're going to have to get an assist on that. But my doctor, she's my age. She's 47 years old. She's my wife's physician as well. I became her patient when I was 30, and she's retiring, and she wants to spend more time with her children. And my wife, there's a clinic close to her office, and out of professional courtesy, she took my wife on, and I'm hoping she takes me on too. But these numbers, there's no way we're keeping up with filling in this loss of this labor pool, if you will, and it's incredible.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if I may respond,
yeah, please.
Actually, this problem is not limited to rural Oregon. If you do not have a primary care physician in Oregon and Bend, a Medicare patient, or a commercial patient, it is very difficult to find practices that are open because they are slammed, which is my technical term, and there are not enough physicians behind them. This is a big, big deal. So I hope maybe this might be a topic during the interim for further discussion.
Thank you. Representative?
This is actually coupled, Mr. Chair, this is actually coupled, too, with the fact that it's very difficult to recruit in the state of Oregon because of the malpractice situation we have. And the big concern in Southern Oregon, I've met with several specialists and OBGY, vascular surgeons, neurologists. Their big concern is within 10 years, you're going to be very shallow on those types of specialties because people have the option to go to State A or State B, whereas we are being State B. You have a very good chance of losing everything you work for, whereas you go in State A, you have some protection. So therefore, it's a matter of money. It's a matter of risk. So therefore, we aren't recruiting like we could.
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate Corey's comments about the malpractice premiums stabilizing and slightly decreasing. My caveat is that they went up well over 100% from 2001 to today, and in some instances much worse, and it has had a direct impact, I think, on our ability to recruit and retain physicians. It's unfortunate.
Any more questions, Mr. Gallant? All right. Thank you, sir. Appreciate
thank you.
I'm going to call three folks up, Elizabeth Steiner, Dr. Steiner, Ed Patterson, and John Mullen, please. And doctor, whenever you're ready, go right ahead and start right out.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for offering the opportunity to testify on Senate Bill 183 on behalf of the Oregon Academy of Family Physicians. Family physicians provide a substantial percentage of care to people around Oregon, and in particular in rural parts of our state. And the malpractice premium subsidy offered by what was originally 3630 and is now 183 has provided the opportunity for many of these physicians to stay in practice and continue to provide these services to Oregonians in more remote parts of our state. The proposed revisions to the existing legislation contain several important provisions that would address concerns that have been present. First, the majority of the subsidy would now be focused on those health professionals who are providing what we call critical access services, or as we talked about when we were in the work group, things we can't fly people out to get. Primary care, maternity care, general surgery. Things that will really stabilize patients and make sure that they're safe to get them to more advanced care if that's what they need. But we can't ask women to fly out to deliver their babies. Second, this legislation would now expand the subsidy to offer support to nurse practitioners, midwives, and certified registered nurse anesthetists who would be supporting important primary care services, and in particular anesthesiology around the state. These mid-level practitioners, for want of a better term, offer very important services and increase access to health care services around rural Oregon, and it's only appropriate that they be included in the subsidy. Many of these people work closely with family doctors or even work independently, and we want to be able to support them as well. Third, the subsidy would focus really on who it was originally intended for, health professionals who work in the most rural or remote parts of our state. The geographic redefinitions that are part of the revised language in 183 assure that the subsidy will support communities who have the most difficulty recruiting healthcare professionals to work for them. Finally, the Oregon Academy of Family Physicians continues to support the concept that patients and physicians would be best served if all physicians and other healthcare professionals took care of Medicare and Medicaid patients on an equitable basis. These patients are historically underserved, and care for them is under-reimbursed. And if all of us provide our equitable portion of this care, then everybody will be better off. So the Oregon Academy of Family Physicians strongly supports Senate Bill 183 as it is now proposed, and we look forward to the opportunity to continuing to serve patients around Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center, and the Oregon Law Center works on behalf of low-income people statewide. My comments will be very brief. I've been involved in the discussion about health care reform this session, and the issues that are facing us in Oregon and nationwide are really indeed staggering. But one feature of the bill that I really appreciate that is in here is the reinsurance subsidies. While it's a very good policy, the linkage as well to coverage for Medicare and Medicaid is important. In other words, having insurance but having no access is not a solution. So I really appreciate having the Medicare and Medicaid connection here. Thank you very much.
Mr. Patterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Ed Patterson. I'm representing the Oregon Rural Health Association. I'm the executive director and have been for a couple of years. Before that, many years ago, I was a rural hospital administrator in Oregon, and I'm telling you the only thing that hasn't been said, and I totally support everything that has been said, but something that hasn't been said is when you're recruiting physicians or any kind of nurse professional associates for a hospital, as an example, for a community, it is a community effort. And one of the things people look at when they come and look at your community and your hospitals, number one, can I make a living here? And the truth is that most rural practitioners make about half of what their urban counterparts do. So that's a big problem. And the second thing is, what is the patient mix in that community? And most rural communities have a higher number of Medicare patients and a higher number of Medicaid patients. You've heard the problems that that creates with reimbursement. So I think that if we don't pass this bill, and I don't know what's going to be done in the next 4 to 8 years to make sure that the malpractice crisis doesn't exist, but if we don't pass it, we're going to lose many, many practitioners in the state due to retirement and due to economic reasons. So I urge you to pass the bill.
Yeah, I'm confident we're going to pass a bill. Any questions of these nice folks? All right, then. Thank you very much. I appreciate everything you've done
Thank
for
you.
The state and this topic. Would anyone else like to speak or testify to Senate Bill 183A today? And we're not moving it today. We will be, next week's our last, Wednesday's our last day, and it will be the last day. So be prepared to work all these through to the end. If seeing no one else, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 183A, and I'm going to open the public hearing on Senate Bill 404A. And I really would like to get done at 5. We can stay later, but just want to let you all know that's my goal. Teresa, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 404A allows for the payment of reasonable costs for records, expert opinions, and witness fees associated with appealing a workers' compensation claim if the claimant prevails. The measure also caps reimbursement for reasonable costs at $1,500 unless the claimant demonstrates extraordinary circumstances justifying payment for a greater amount. The bill passed unanimously both out of the Senate Commerce Committee and out of the Senate and does have the support of the Management Labor Advisory Committee. You have in front of you two amendments, the -A3 amendment adds several types of cancers to the existing firefighter presumption for employment caused occupational diseases for workers' compensation and requires the presumption to be made by cities that provide a separate disability and retirement system, but it also allows cities to enter agreements which allow administrative law judges that are employed by the Workers' Compensation Board to decide disputes in those types of cases. And the A4 amendment clarifies the intent of the A and gross measure. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Just committee members, this may look familiar. It's a similar language you see in Senate Bill 560. Just for the heads up there. I'm going to call Kelly Bach, Bill Humbert, and Ed Hall. Gentlemen, whoever wants to go first.
I'll start out. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kelly Bach. I'm the president of the Oregon State Firefighters Council, representing 3,000 paid firefighters in Oregon and 44 locals. I'm also a line captain for Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue. Today, my comments are for the Oregon State Firefighters Council. What we'll address today is just specifically the -A3 amendments, not any other portion of the bill. Originally, this was known as Senate Bill 560, but Senate Bill 404, it'll add 7 specific cancers to the presumption of cause for firefighters, and it'll also include all paid full-time firefighters in Oregon. Previously, it would have included the volunteers, but due to some testimony from the Special Districts Associations and others at both MWAC and in the Senate Commerce Committee, the language was narrowed to not include volunteer firefighters, and that was due to the testimony of the employer groups. We didn't have a position on that. This bill did pass unanimously out of MWAC, having received considerable testimony at that process and passed unanimously with all the employer reps.
So I can clarify, Kelly, you mean the presumption.
Correct.
Consult, not the trial lawyers mean.
Yes, just the -A3 portion of this, just the specific cancers, and their intent was also to not cover volunteers, and then also the other provisions of the bill. That's the only part that MWAC took a position on. One thing I want to address in the bill is that it does also cover the city of Portland firefighters. Specifically, if you look at this page 3, line 27, it says, any city providing disability retirement system by ordinance or charter for firefighters and police officers not subject to this chapter shall apply the presumptions established under this section when processing claims for firefighters. So it does also cover Portland firefighters for just the presumption portion. Okay. So as I said, it did pass unanimously out of MWAC. 25 other states do now have cancer presumption. Just this last week, Vermont added cancer, and so did Colorado. Colorado passed the bill with our original cancers covered, the three body systems and brain and skin. We've narrowed it down just to 7 cancers from the original bill, so it's really been cut down a lot. We think that's significant that other states have seen the importance of this and recognize exposures and the illnesses that firefighters are contracting. We have had a heart-lung presumption since the 1960s with firefighters. And from some information from the DCBS they've given us, over the last 12 years, using this rebuttable presumption criteria, the firefighters have only won 23.1% of heart cases and 38.9% of respiratory system cases and no circulatory system cases. And the reason I say that, tell you about this, is because it is a rebuttable presumption, and employers can make a case to show why an employee should not get this benefit. It just simply changes the onus from the employee to the employer, though. So if we do get cancer, now they would show that it wasn't caused on the job. And a little bit later, I'll talk about our exposures and the link from exposures and the scientific studies. So I'll talk a little bit real quick. You have all this in the documents, and I know we're really busy, so I'll try to get through this as quick as I can. Some of the known carcinogens that firefighters are exposed to, and these are carcinogens that have been tested at fire scenes and are known carcinogens. And what that means, it's known to cause cancer in humans. A possible carcinogen is one that causes in lab rats, things like that. So some of the known carcinogens they've actually measured in fires are things such as asbestos, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, formaldehyde, of course, diesel exhaust at the fire station. Acrolein is present in most firefighters, and it metabolites into a known carcinogen. Acrylonitrile is used in textiles, and it is converted in the body to cyanide and causes cancer in animals and probably humans, and causes such specific cancers as prostate, stomach, colon, brain, blood, and the lymphatic system, some of the ones that are listed in your 7, and then vinyl chloride. There's also carbon monoxide, which turns into a carcinogen, and then soot contains, obviously we have a lot of that at fires, we get that on our skin, and it has known carcinogens in it. Many other chemicals are obviously on file in the EPA, and they don't even know what those are when they're exposed to humans. They haven't tested all of them. There's thousands and thousands of them, and they really don't know what happens when those burn, and firefighters are subjected to those in fires. So in addition to those known carcinogens, there's also many other carcinogens that we don't even know what they are that we're entering when we go into these fires. One of the things that I think is important to understand is the fires aren't like TV. When we crawl in there, it's black smoke. You can't even see your hand. We're going in these fires. We don't know what's in the smoke. We just go in and do our job. After the fire, we take a shower, do all that kind of stuff, clean up. We wear our masks during the fire and all of our safety equipment. And then even a day later when I get home, we can still smell smoke in our skin when we take a shower. It's still coming off us even after a couple showers. Right when I get home the next morning, my wife knows I had a fire because she can smell it on me. And if you ask nearly all firefighters, they would say the same thing. It's a pretty universal thing how we're getting these exposures through our skin, hair, all that, in addition to breathing them during overhaul phases and things such as that. So let me go. So now I'll just talk real quick just about some of the research and statistical excesses. In November 2006, the Journal of Occupational Environmental Medicine did a study that reviewed 32 studies that have been done on cancer in firefighters. There's been more, but they just reviewed 32 studies that have been done over the years. And they found that we are at an increased risk for 10 specific types of cancers. Then additionally, in the Senate Commerce Committee, we were fortunate enough to have Dr. T. Gudati come out and testify in favor of our original bill with all the cancers. And he's the chair of the Department of Environmental and Occupational Health and professional of environmental occupational health at the George Washington School of Public Health in Washington, D.C., and he's also a professor there. And then in 2006, Dr. Gadotti began a one-year term as president of the American College of Occupational and Environmental Medicine. Those are the type of doctors that study these type of exposures, and he came out and testified. We couldn't get him here on the short notice, but he came out and testified for our original bill covering many more cancers in favor of that bill. And then I'll just go through real quick and talk about some of the specific cancers that we're now asking for, and the studies that have shown an increased risk, in addition to the meta-analysis by the Masters. Well, brain cancer, epidemiologic studies consistently have found that brain cancer is strongly associated with firefighting, and several studies have found 2 to 3 times excess in firefighters when compared to the general population. Brain cancer deaths in firefighters range from double the risk in a study of almost 6,000 firefighters in Toronto to 3.8 times the risk in firefighters in Hawaii. That's just a couple of the studies on brain cancer specifically. Then lymphoma. Several studies of firefighters evaluated this group of malignant diseases. Without exception, marked increases in risk were found. The study from the Massachusetts Cancer Registry by SAMA found a statistically significant risk of 3.2 times for firefighters relative to police officers. So what's significant about that? That's comparing two healthy worker populations, and I'll talk a little bit about that in a few minutes. And then also studies from Giles in Melbourne, Australia, and Aronson from Toronto reported that firefighters had twice the risk of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma compared to males in the general population. And then multiple myeloma, that's again one of our cancers that's proposed in this bill. Several studies have also shown a markedly increased analysis of a cohort of Seattle firefighters by Higher, just up by 5, showed 2.25 times increased risk of death from multiple myeloma for firefighters. The risk increased to statistically significant 9.89 for firefighters with 30 years or more on the job. And then the meta-analysis by LeMasters and colleagues, which was one of the strictest studies and narrowed down most of the bills, still found that firefighters have a statistically significant increase in cancers. And what that term means is that it just didn't happen by chance, that reached a threshold in the study to show that firefighters are at an increased risk in numerous studies when they put them together under 3 strict standards, and they still found an increased risk. Another one is colon cancer, one of the 7. And of particular relevance to the firefighters, the higher than expected rates of colon cancer. Again, Maul and colleagues found more than double the risk of colon cancer for African-American firefighters, which was statistically significant. And then Vina and Fielder, who studied 1,867 firefighters from Buffalo, New York, again found statistically significant increase in colon cancer of 1.83, almost double the amount of the general population. And then they found their risk increased to 4.71, or almost 5 times for firefighters with the longest employment, so they're suggesting there are dose response trend. And then, of course, we have on our list is stomach cancer, and they found 2-fold risk in one study. Another study found 2.89, another study found 2.64. I won't give you the authors, trying to get through this fast for you. And then prostate cancer. Studies on prostate cancers have consistently found an increased risk in firefighters. While the majority of studies found 30 to 50% increased risk, still statistically significant in these studies, at least 2 studies have found a greater than double risk for firefighters. Giles and colleagues found 2.09%, and Grimes found 2.61%. And then again in the LeMaster studies, which put all the studies together and applied their strictest standards, it was one of the highest ranked cancers. Was prostate cancer. And then finally, there's testicular cancer. Again, Mullen and colleague found in the Toronto study that 2.52 times increased risk, and then the Masters studies also found 2 times increased risk. And that, again, was one of the strictest studies. Make sure I get all those. So we think there's a whole pack of studies I have, and in that information I have a list of all the studies that have been done. Each in the column it shows all the cancers that had a statistically significant increased risk in firefighters, and it showed the author and how many firefighters were studied in that sample. Just so you can reference that if you like. So then I'll talk a little bit about the cost estimate, because that's obviously something that's important to everyone here in this building and us also. The National Council on Compensation Insurance recently reported that this legislation may result in a 5 to 30% increase in workers' compensation costs. Well, that might sound high. 10 to 15% increase on these rates would be equivalent to $6 to $12 per firefighter. And what I did there is took where I work, the biggest special district in Oregon, took their workers' compensation costs, divided by number of firefighters, and put that multiplier 15% was $6 to $12. And then they also reported, the NCCI also reported, that it would be a negligible cost increase to the overall workers' compensation system. And one thing I want to tell you real quick about NCCI, because they just sent out a newer letter May 18th, and it's also in your packet, that what that is. The National Council on Compensation Insurance is the oldest and largest provider of statistics and employee injury data for workers' compensation insurance in the nation. Established as a not-for-profit company in 1992, NCCI analyzes industry trends, prepares workers' compensation insurance rates recommendations, assists in analyzing proposed legislation, and provides a variety of data products to more than 900 insurance companies and nearly 40 state governments. NCCI does not have a position on this bill, so they were giving a neutral cost estimate of our bill. So with that, in closing, just to keep it brief, because you have a lot of information, we have other testimony today. We know from the scientific evidence that firefighters are exposed to these carcinogens. We know that we're catching cancer at a higher rate than other citizens. And this is just isn't anecdotal. This is scientifically studied. It's not just picking cancers here and there. We looked at the studies. And in MLAC, it was narrowed down to the seven of the highest. I could argue, of course, that there's 15 or 20 more, but those seven are some of the highest. Numerous other states have passed this. This isn't a windfall for the firefighters to get workers' compensation benefits. All it is simply health care coverage for that incidence, some time loss benefits, and then a death benefit, because, frankly, a lot of these cancers are fatal type of cancers. So we think it's important for our members and for the legislation to recognize this risk that the firefighters are taking and support our amended bill. Thank you. I'll take any questions or afterwards.
Mr. Hall, go ahead.
Mr. Humbert?
Thank you very much for giving me an opportunity to speak on a subject I have a strong passion for. The record, my name is Bill Humbert. I'm a cancer survivor. I was hired as a firefighter in October of 1973. In the spring of 1983, I noticed a lump on the side of my neck. Went to my primary care physician, referred me to a surgeon, ear, nose, throat, and neck surgeon. He surgically removed it in May. 3 days later, tells me, that's a malignant tumor. You have non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. I went through 6 months of chemotherapy treatments, 5 weeks of radiation treatments. I retired in November of 99. In April of 2005, I started noticing some gallbladder pains. Went to my primary care physician, who referred me to a surgeon, palpates my abdomen and says, you have a mass in your abdomen. When I remove your gallbladder, go back to your cancer doctor. Remove my gallbladder. I go back to my cancer doctor, who told me, he says, I've been watching your spleen enlarge for about 3 years now. I suggest you have it removed. In August of 2005, I had my spleen removed. A few days later, pathology comes back. He says, we noticed some small cell lymphoma in there. First question I ask him, he says, why did this reoccur? He says, this has probably been laying dormant in you for about 20 years now. It may have mutated from the large cell you had in 1983. I went in September of 2005. I did once a week for 4 weeks a drug called Rituxan. And March of 2006, I did 4 more treatments of Rituxan. I've been in remission ever since. I'm one of the lucky ones. For the last 11 years of my career, I worked in downtown Portland at Station 1. Four firefighters at that station have non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. Two are dead right now. One just finished a course of treatment, and he's at home, hoping he makes it. I'm lucky. I'm in remission. I have a list of 36 firefighters right here since 1995 in Portland who have either died or in remission. One of these firefighters on this list is a fellow named Steve Hagley. His widow, Carolyn, has come down here twice now to talk about this bill. Unfortunately, she can't be here today. She has a family, her mom's had a stroke and is in the hospital. Sitting next to me is Ed Hall, vice president of our union. Steve died in December of 04. Before Ed speaks, I'd like to say one more thing. I would not forgive myself if I wasn't sitting here right now talking about cancer and firefighters. And 25 other states have approved this as occupational. Do the right things for our firefighters. Ed?
Thank you. My name is Edward Hall. I'm the Vice President of the Portland Firefighters Association, and I'm here today on behalf of the nearly 700 men and women who proudly serve the city of Portland as firefighters. In my 29-plus years as a firefighter, I've seen many of my co-workers get cancer. Some of them, like Bill, have been fortunate, but far too many have not. As you're probably aware, Kelly told you, that the city of Portland has its own unique system for disability and retirement. And I hope to convey to you all here today that this legislation before you is very important to my members because it will positively impact the fire disability and retirement system for the city of Portland, and it will positively impact my members. Now, over the years, within the city of Portland, as these cancer cases have come forward, we have been successful in showing the connection between firefighting and cancer. And the real bitter irony to this, though, is that at the time of life, or at the end of life, when one should be spending their time focused on their recovery, on their treatment, and on their family, at that time, our members are spending their time, their dollars, involved in a legal process to prove what it is we already understand. If it pleases the chair, I'd like to read a letter from a widow of Steve Hagley, Carolyn Hagley. And as Bill said, she had hoped to be here today and is unable to. And so I'll just, if you don't mind, like this. Okay, thank you. I'd like to hope you'll forgive me. Steve was a very close friend of mine. Thank you for listening to me in regard to non-Hodgkin's lymphoma and other certain cancers as they are related to the occupation of firefighting. This was an important subject to my husband, Steve Hagley, long before his illness, as well as one that has hit me between the eyes. I met Steve in 1983. One of the first things he shared with me was his dream to become a Portland firefighter. His dream was realized in 1985. We married in 87 and were blessed with four children who are now the ages of 17, 15, 7, and 5. In October 2003, Steve had severe abdominal pain. His doctor found several masses and immediately ordered a CAT scan that same day. We received results later that day and were told we were probably dealing with some sort of lymphoma. We were sent to a surgeon for a biopsy, which meant abdominal surgery and 3 days in the hospital. The following week, a CAT scan was ordered and final results were revealed. Stage 3, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. We started chemotherapy treatment immediately and continued for 6 months. We were hopeful for a remission, but a month later it was apparent that more treatment was needed. We started new treatment, and that was four times more rigorous than the previous treatment, and preparation for a stem cell transplant, which would include full body radiation. The stem cell transplant took place in September of 2004. During those 11 months of treatment, Steve, along with other firefighters, went to the Portland archives and recorded all the calls he had been on throughout his career. of 19 years. They included many chemical exposures present at those calls. From there, research was done to find out if there were any chemicals directly related to the onset of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and if there were, was Steve exposed to those chemicals while on duty? Several chemicals were found. Some of those were present at some of his calls. One chemical we found Steve was exposed to every day he was on duty, benzene. This information, along with letters from three doctors, was taken to the Portland Pension Board. They made their decision and found Steve's cancer was occupational. This decision was made September of 2004, in the middle of his stem cell transplant, 11 months after his original diagnosis. While we are grateful for the board's decision, we were not prepared for the problems of reversing all the medical bills from our medical insurance to disability. While we are fighting for Steve's life, some of the medical bills slipped through the cracks and were not discovered until later, causing some problems. Steve lived a clean, healthy lifestyle. He didn't smoke, didn't drink, he exercised regularly, and enjoyed being active outside, especially at our home in the country. He was careful to have healthy eating habits as well. Steve was the youngest of seven siblings and four and a half siblings. His father today is over 80 years old and is still healthy. The only person related to him who's had cancer was his mother. She died from lung cancer at the age of 76 after 60 years of smoking. Unfortunately, the stem cell transplant was not the end of this nightmare. A month after the stem cell transplant, Steve needed to undergo more radiation. Then things turned even worse. See, the last time our children saw him was Christmas of 2004. Steve died December 30th, 2004, at the age of 42. Firefighters risk their lives every day. They are on duty to protect the lives and property of those in their care. I am asking you to take care of them and make a decision to make certain these cancers are occupational. Thank you. That's from Carolyn Higley.
Are you finished, sir?
Yes, sir.
Thank you very much. Any questions, these gentlemen? I do have a technical question, Kelly.
Okay.
Just to clarify the record here, on page 3 of the dash 3s, at the bottom, line 27, that's the language that clearly states that Portland is not exempt from presumption.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that is correct. They are covered on the presumption for these seven specific cancers.
Thank you very much. Any further questions? Thank you, gentlemen.
Can I say one thing
about your loss, too, believe me, and tell that nice lady that her and her family will be in our thoughts and prayers. Bill?
Thank you, Chairman.
Can I say one more thing?
Yes, sir.
I went with Steve when he did his chemo, when Steve did his stem cell up at Good Sam. Talked to the nurse up there, and I says, how's he doing? He says, everything we have tried with him has turned to, put a off-color word in there.
Right.
Okay. And I wouldn't forgive myself if I wasn't sitting here.
Well, thank you, Bill. Thank all you guys for your service. I greatly appreciate it, believe me. I would like to call Nelson Hall and Pat West, please. And folks, we're hearing the amendment. I don't think the actual bill is contentious at all. So we will have the trial lawyers when we hear it next week come and just describe the actual bill. Unless, I don't know, maybe somebody's on the list of talk about the original bill. Okay, we'll get to you guys in just a minute. Pat, if you're ready, go ahead, please.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Pat West, former president of the Oregon State Firefighters. And also, I've served two terms on MLAC. So I felt there were some things that I could add to this. It's very difficult for this not to touch me, being a firefighter. And also, I have a son that's currently a firefighter, and my father passed away at 49 from cancer, and he was a firefighter. So it's an issue that is near and dear to me. But the reason I'm testifying today is to kind of bring it together a little bit. The issues, the technicalities that Kelly was talking about, the percentages that firefighters have, are real. But workers' comp, in and of itself, is very complex, as you folks know. And that was the creation of MLAC. MLAC was to be a screening device that just kind of, you know, laid out issues, kept an even keel on the issues of workers' comp. And so it's highly unusual for a bill that's this specific for individual firefighters in this case to make it through MLAC with a unanimous vote. And I just thought it was very important for people in this room to understand the importance of that. There's management, there's labor, and it was unanimously voted out of committee. It was amended. So it wasn't the original bill. It wasn't all that the firefighters asked for. It wasn't all that the employers asked for. And I just think it's necessary to point that out and to also understand the rigors that it did go through to make it through MLAC. And with that, I'll close.
Sir, go ahead, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Nelson Hall. I'm an attorney with the law firm of Bennett, Hartman, Morris, and Kaplan in Portland, and have had the honor for over 20 years to represent injured workers in this state, specifically firefighters and police officers that serve our communities, and specifically the State Association of Firefighters. And indeed, I had the great honor of representing Mr. Stephen Higley in his cancer case, and Mrs. Higley after Steve's death. In addition, if I might add, I was appointed by Governor Barbara Roberts in 1993 to the State Workers' Compensation Appeals Board. I served on that board for 5 years, including chairing that board for two of those years. I have taught workers' compensation law, or did, for about 7 years as an adjunct to Northwestern School of Law at Lewis and Clark College in Portland. I offer my credentials simply to point out that this is a subject that is not new to me, nor providing testimony in front of the legislature, not new to me. Members of the committee, a couple quick points and I'm finished. Number one, the science is here to support these presumptions, specifically those seven cancers for which this bill has been narrowed. I emphasize again, as Mr. West did, this bill, as it presents to you, passed unanimously out of the Management Labor Advisory Committee, the gateway, if you will, on what workers' compensation issues in this state. The reason I wanted to address the committee is this. There's a need for a presumption, and that is because of the extreme cost, expense, time, energy, emotion that goes into having to stop and reinvent the wheel with each of these cancer cases. Indeed, because of the latency period with some of these cancers, think, for example, asbestos, oftentimes well over 20 years before the cancer manifests itself, you are then, the firefighter, required under current law, without the benefit of this presumption, to go back to archives. As you heard testimony about Mr. Higley's case, it took an army of his fellow firefighters to go back into archives and actually record the runs that he had made over his years as a firefighter. You take that data to a hazard material expert, and ask what were in these fires. And you take the chemical analysis from hazmat and you go to the oncologists and have them come at a great expense testify or offer reports in order to win an individual firefighter's case. We end up proving that. My point is presumption is needed so we don't have to stop and reinvent the wheel every single time. I stand ready for questions. Thank you.
Any questions of these gentlemen? Hey, Representative Holy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have to ask this question, and it's not that I doubt any of the presumptions of these seven cancers, but I'm curious because, you know, today we probably have more female firefighters than we did 20 years ago, I would assume, maybe not. But just in relationship to the prostate cancer and the testicular cancer and the genitourinary system, was there any increase, I guess, evidence that females were also affected somehow that men weren't, and are they covered?
One of you guys want to come up and help out here?
I just want to make sure that we're being fair to everybody that's serving.
I think that's an excellent question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holby. That was something that we looked at, and unfortunately, as you know, over the years there hasn't been as many female firefighters. So a lot of the studies that have been done haven't had a high enough amount of females to show statistical significance. So we, even though the genitourinary system would have covered some of the female reproductive systems, it was narrowed at MLAC, not because we wanted that, but that's because what they did it there. That took out some of those reproductive issues. But breast cancer, the International Association of Firefighters is looking at that currently. We are looking into it. We didn't take it for granted because where I work, one of our females is a survivor of breast cancer and works at the King City Station. So it's something that's really important to us. We had women looking into it, and there's 10% of the women where I 10% of our workforce is women where I work. So it's just something that we haven't been able to get the science to back up yet. So that's why we did not specifically bring breast cancer. We brought cancers that were scientifically backed up. So I hope.
Any further questions, these gentlemen?
Mr. Chair, yes, just to come in, and I think that a number of women that I know have looked at this bill and questioned why it had certain gender-specific cancers and didn't have female reproductive cancers. But I looked through some of the studies that you provided us, and it looks like maybe there hasn't been enough experience of women in the profession over time to actually do studies on those cancers. And breast cancer, I would think, I mean, it's pretty, I think, widely known that smoke inhalation is a risk factor for breast cancer. And so I would assume that over time some epidemiological studies will be done, and it may turn up some higher rates of those cancers, too, among firefighters.
So. And, Representative, I believe these fire retardant chemicals that they put on these fabrics have shown up in women's breast milk. So I think there's probably a pretty easily direct correlation, but I'll let you respond, but I just wanted to throw that out there, too.
Representative Rosenbaum, Chairman Schaffler, I think you're exactly right. You know, we have 15 women out of 300 where I work, and there's, 10%, there's probably 300 in the state. And so that is exactly why they haven't been able to reach the statistically significant threshold, because you need a certain amount of members in any epidemiological study to make it sound. Not that I don't believe it's happening and that it's causing breast cancer, but we didn't want to bring something forward that we didn't have the evidence to back it up.
Thank you, Representative.
Just to follow up, Mr. Chair, I would hope that I'm sure your organization is looking at this closely, but it would seem like even though you don't have a statistically large enough pool of women in to make this conclusion, I would guess that there's probably studies out there that can make a correlation so that you could make that conclusion. And I think maybe that may be a way you need to go to make sure that you're protecting the females in your organization as you are the men.
I'm fairly confident our firefighter brothers here would be happy to add a long list of cancers for their firefighter sisters. But I think it's one step at a time. You guys want to respond to what Representative Holby said?
Let me go ahead. Mr. Chair, Representative Holby, the original bill that the firefighters submitted included all of what you've discussed. The bill that came out of MLAC was pared down to those that showed the significant numbers. But we're certainly not opposed to any changes that you'd like to make to the bill.
We're going to fight like dogs to get these seven. And, I'd go in the opposite direction and add to them. So any further questions?
Further questions?
Representative Edwards.
I noticed I was just going through the list of cancers that are included in other state policies, and if my math is correct, my tallying here, it looks like that of the other states that have cancer presumption, God, my voice, excuse me, 17 states include more cancers than Oregon would. And the most common one of all the cancers, and there's a big list of different, several states include all, leukemia is included in 8 of the states, and it's the one that comes up the most common that is not included in Oregon. So I just thought I'd ask you, what was the talk about leukemia in particular?
Chairman Schaffler, Representative Edwards, again, I believe that cancer does have an increased risk in firefighters and should or could be on the list. From when I looked at that, I saw us down to the second to the lowest. Only one that I saw was Maryland lowest. There might have been a couple other that were 7. You know, again, Colorado just passed our original bill. In Vermont, a week ago, they just passed a bill that covered probably 15 to 18 cancers. So, you know, we're in a position to trying to get a bill passed to protect as many firefighters as we can. Obviously, we would love to have many, many more cancers covered that protect our firefighters that we believe the science backs up. But we also had to make it MLAC comfortable, make the employer groups comfortable. That's how a unanimous vote happened. And so that's where we are with that.
Thank you. We're going to have to move on, guys. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'd like to call Randy Elmer and Martin Alvey. And we're going to hear about the actual Senate Bill 404, which I don't think there's a lot of contention here, gentlemen. So if you can keep it tight.
I'll keep it short.
Thank you.
Try to. This bill had its origin because... I'm sorry. I'm Martin Alvey.
Thank you.
And I'm a trial lawyer from Portland. The bill had its origin about 4 years ago because of some changes that were made in the 2001 legislature. The burden of proof had shifted over to employers on certain complex medical conditions. And what we were seeing in the trial bar was that insurance companies were increasing the amounts of money they were spending to defeat injured workers' claims because they now had the burden of proof. And as a result of that, injured workers could not keep possibly up with what was being spent by the insurance companies to marshal the medical evidence to try to defeat a claim. And so this concept had its genesis about that time to try to get injured workers on somewhat of an even playing field with the insurance companies. What this bill does is allows injured workers to recover up to $1,500 of their out-of-pocket costs from the insurance company if they prevail on a denied claim. If they lose, they're still out the money. If they win, they now get not only their attorney fees, which is what the previous law was. If you win, you get your attorney fees reimbursed, but it also allows for up to $1,500 in out-of-pocket costs. It also has an escape clause that says if you have an extraordinarily complex case or a case with extraordinary circumstances and you can make a showing to an administrative law judge of those extraordinary circumstances, then you can exceed that $1,500 cap. All of these costs need to be approved by an administrative law judge before they're reimbursed. That's the genesis and the net effect of the bill.
Go ahead.
For the record, Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee, my name is Randy Elmer. I'm an attorney here in Salem. I'm a member of the Kreiger Alexander Law Firm. We have offices in Salem and Albany. I've been representing injured workers for about 24 years. I'm just here to speak today to the -A4 amendment, which amends ORS 656388 to allow, for the first time in our law, a statutory lien for attorney's fees to attorneys who represent injured workers who, for whatever reason, after giving time and effort to assisting them in developing their cases, may part company with that injured worker. So out of any future awards or settlements that the attorney can show he was instrumental in bringing to the table and helping the worker achieve, if he files a request for a lien with the Work Comp Board and the judge or the board approves that lien, then it will attach to that recovery. We had many discussions with SAFE, Liberty Northwest. We have no further opposition from either of them. Discussed this with the Work Comp Board and have had numerous discussions about implementing this bill. And that's going to be that will have to be done mostly through the rulemaking process. And I intend to be a part of that because I've made some representations about how this bill will be implemented. And I'm going to carry that through. But it's necessary because we are reaching levels of lack of representation, I guess for lack of a better term, of attorneys who want to represent injured workers in the state of Oregon than we've ever seen before. We've gone from about 225 in pre-1990 days to about, to the latest head count, 50 to 55 lawyers of the Oregon State Bar who will step up and represent injured workers. And when we ask people who are trying to recruit to our ranks to come do that, they say, look, I just got out of law school, I got $100,000 in debt, and you tell me, come to a practice as contingency. Come to a practice that you win only 42% of the time. They have 25% and 10% fees, caps of $1,000, $2,000, $1,500 in costs. And not only that, you have no statutory protection if you're fired even on a whim. Yeah, that's the area of practice we're trying to entice you to come into. They're not very eager to do so. This will help fill a void by giving some assurances to attorneys that they won't work for free in this arena. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions, these gentlemen? Thank you very much, guys.
Thank you.
All right, I'd like to call in here a little different side of the story here. I think Tina Squires, Matthew Durley, and Frank Stratton, please. Whoever wants to go first, go right ahead and start right off.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Hasina Squires here today on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon, which represents approximately 900 special service districts throughout the state of Oregon. Our largest type of service district that we represent are rural fire protection districts. Of the 900 special districts that we represent, 275 of those members are rural fire protection districts. We also operate a self-insured pool. Rural fire protection districts are the largest type of special districts for which our insurance pool writes workers' comp coverage for. We currently write coverage for 165 special service districts that are fire districts. I'm also here today on behalf of the Oregon Fire District Directors Association, which is an association that represents elected officials. The elected officials of the fire district boards, typically a fire district has a five-member board, and I'm here on behalf of those 800 elected officials throughout the state of Oregon in opposition to the A3 amendments to Senate Bill 404. And I want to be very, very clear, because I have great respect for Mr. Elmer and Mr. Alvey, that we are not here to oppose their bill in any way. As you have heard, Senate Bill 560 does create a presumption for paid firefighters. The bill expressly excludes volunteer firefighters with the language that has been inserted into the A3 amendments. I want to be clear here that current statute already provides workers' compensation coverage for cancer that's contracted on the job. There is a mechanism that is currently available and a remedy for people who contract cancer that is on the job. As you've heard, the bill adds brain cancer, colon cancer, stomach cancer, testicular cancer, prostate cancer, multiple myeloma, and non-Hodgkin's lymphoma to the presumption standard under Senate Bill 560, and would place firefighters with five or more years of employment in a preferred category where they wouldn't be subject to the same proof requirements for occupational and industrial injuries as all other occupations that have significant exposure to potential carcinogenic issues, like bartenders, waitresses, waiters who are consistently exposed to cigarette smoke, diesel mechanics, and construction demolition employees. The bill applied. There are 7,666 firefighters in the state of Oregon. Of that, 41% or 3,172 of those firefighters are paid firefighters in the state. So we're talking about 3,172 firefighters. Some of those firefighters don't spend a very limited amount of time actually responding to fires. The district, the largest fire district in the state of Oregon, Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue, which Mr. Bach coincidentally happens to work for, according to their data, last year they responded to 3,500 alarms in a year. Of those, 75.8% of those calls were for medical service requests. Those calls that aren't EMS-related are responses to fires, which are structure, vehicle, wild land, and other, and then hazardous condition service calls and all other miscellaneous requests fall into the 24.2% category. I'd like to direct your attention to my testimony, which is in this fabulous binder that many of you have sitting on your shelves collecting dust or opened at some point, and just go over a little bit about, before I get into the fiscal information, the testimony that's contained in the binder. We were not able to bring our bring medical expert Dr. Noel Weiss from University of Washington down here, but his testimony is contained in the binder. I'd like to go over his credentials. He has an MD from Stanford University, a PhD in epidemiology and biostatistics from Harvard. So this is not this is somebody who has actual epidemiological experience. He's a faculty member of the Department of Epidemiology, School of Public Health and Community Medicine at UW Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research since 1973, and has co-authored 500 articles in medical journals, and 2/3 of those articles have been in the area of cancer. The Lemaster study, tab 12 of my testimony includes the actual Lemaster study, where there's been a lot of discussion about the Lemaster's meta-analysis, and it's not a study, it's a meta-analysis. It takes into consideration a number of studies that have been conducted recently and puts them into a matrix type of system. And what the newest Lemaster's matrix shows is that there are it directs your attention to three cancers that come in as more than unlikely and more than possibly related to firefighting. Page 8 of my testimony, prostate cancer. The explanation that we would like to give for the potential increased risk for prostate cancer is there obviously must be something wrong with the studies in the Lemaster meta-analysis. Of four studies that were analyzed by Lemasters, they observed an increased risk in firefighters with the shortest duration of employment, which is exactly the opposite of what you would expect to see. So the shorter amount of time that you were a firefighter, the higher higher rate you contracted prostate cancer. Clearly, that doesn't draw a causal. There's no causal inference by that. Page 9 of my testimony, multiple myeloma. We believe that the Lemaster's meta-analysis failed to consider a number of studies that could have impact on the conclusions. There were 8 other studies that Lemaster's did not include in their meta-analysis that could have possibly impacted the conclusions that were drawn by Lemaster's. And then with respect to non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, on page 10 of my testimony, Lemaster's chose to take the positive study that showed increased risk at 1.4, but did not take the one that showed negative risk at 0.9. So Mr. Bach cited off a number of studies. I could go on ad nauseum with studies that show, no, there's no risk. It's very clear that the science is very unsettled in this area with respect to cancer, in our opinion. Finally, I'd just like to close on the science issue with the fact that this is not a new thing. I've been lobbying since 1993, and I've seen several bills that tried to accomplish this very effect. Back in 1995, it's on tab 11 of my testimony, and actually during the 97 legislative session, the legislature took it upon themselves to refer this issue to the OHSU, Center for Occupational and Environmental Toxicology Research Department, and tab 11 of my testimony contains that report from Crow at OHSU, our very own Oregon experience, who reviewed the data and came up with, if you just flip to it, brain cancer, no increased risk. If you just go down the list, no increased risk, no increased risk. That's our own local data and our own OHSU, CROET, who had opined in that way. And we believe that if the legislature wants CROET to take another look at it and get some more additional Oregon experience and see what's out there, maybe the CROET should be asked to do another review of the literature. Finally, I'd like to go to the fiscal impact, which is on page 3 of my testimony. Our fiscal impact of the provisions of Senate Bill 560 or 404-A3 are based upon health insurance statistics, SDAOs, workers' compensation claim history, and firefighter rates in other states that have a cancer presumption. We're expecting, with the passage of this bill, with the A3 amendments, an increase of $3 million or more in workers' comp claims from fire districts. And you can see, based upon our example below, we project a 350% rate increase. I'd just like to point out that other states that have cancer presumption that's similar to what is being proposed under the provisions of this bill have rates that are 4 to 5 times higher than Oregon. Oregon has prided itself on having low workers' comp rates, and in fact, our association, sort of how we came into existence, was obviously a number of fire districts, and we couldn't get people to write comp coverage for us at a reasonable rate. So we decided to form an association, self-insure, get those rates down, do best practices, and get our fire districts to the point where we could have reasonable workers' comp rates. And we believe we've been able to accomplish that. Oregon's rate is 2.86. Other rates, as you can see, in other states are much higher. Oregon's had a very low NCCI rate, one of the lowest rates in the country. Finally, I'd like to point out a couple of things. To respond to Mr. Bach's testimony, I want to make it very clear that Mr. Bach testified that special districts testified to remove volunteer firefighters from the provisions of the bill, as did MLAC. MLAC, the version that MLAC attempted to forward was to remove volunteers there. So I want to be clear that this is not as special districts has asked for this, and this is the way it's going to be. MLAC asked for volunteers to be removed. 25 other states, he has stated, have cancer presumptions. I'd like to point out, but in all but one of those states, the presumption that is in the statute is rebuttable. We believe that this presumption is not rebuttable, and Mr. Demily will address that issue. And then finally, just if this issue isn't about a windfall for firefighters and it's about health benefits, absolutely. Health benefits. The city of Portland is excluded from the lifetime medical benefit that every other entity would be granted under the provisions of this bill. So if it's about health benefits and providing health insurance for workers, why aren't we addressing that issue, and why are we addressing the workers' compensation presumption issue, where we simply shift the burden of proof from the employee to the employer to prove a negative, which is essentially impossible under the standards of this bill? With that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Denley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Matthew Denley. I've been practicing workers' compensation since 1986 with the law firm of Cummins Goodman and a bunch of other names. I'm going to address 404-A3. Just a couple preliminary remarks with regard to Mr. Humbert, who I have the greatest admiration for being a firefighter. My understanding is that he worked for the city of Portland, and at least for him, the system of providing benefits worked, because my understanding is the claim was actually accepted, benefits paid, medical services provided. There was also testimony from Mr. Nelson Hall that talked about some of the onerous provisions of the presumption, or at least the onerous provisions of attempting to prove compensability. I believe that what Mr. Hall may be referencing is the city of Portland practice, and not necessarily the state of Oregon practice under workers' compensation. The presumption is going to be extended to the city of Portland, which we don't have any problems with. And like Ms. Squires, I would point out that it does not appear under A3 that the lifetime benefits under the Oregon Workers' Compensation Act extends to the city of Portland. It's simply the presumption that's in the statute as currently formulated. So there still seems to be a disconnect then between those benefits under the state of Oregon policy and the city of Portland policy. There is a model, if you will, for perhaps a better way to approach the firefighters' presumption, and that we can look to the city or the state of Washington to the north. In Oregon, normally the claim is filed by a worker who has the burden of proof to prove compensability, and they can do that either under material contributing cause or a major contributing cause. The firefighter presumption turns that on its head and actually puts the burden of proof on the employer to prove by clear and convincing evidence that the condition claimed under the firefighter's presumption is unrelated to work. Mr. Bach testified about other jurisdictions that have passed the presumptions, Colorado being apparently the most recent. I haven't seen the Colorado statute. I'll tell you that right now. I would be surprised if in that statute it had the same language as the Oregon statute, which says that the employer must show that the condition claim is unrelated to work. In the area of settled law, like perhaps lung or cardiovascular, where there is no dispute of scientific evidence, the presumption actually operates so that you can actually claim or defend against a condition like that. In the area of unsettled law, like cancers, the rebuttable presumption under the statute becomes a conclusive presumption in favor of compensability. There is no defense under the statute as currently situated.
Sir, can you just interject real quick here? On the four states where you reference and have seen his testimony here on the rate difference, these four states, Nevada, Maryland, New Hampshire, California, is the rebuttable presumption on the employer or the employee in those four states? Who has the burden in those four states?
I don't know. I'll refer to Ms. Squires.
Okay, and then I'm going to ask one more question. You have four here. I wonder if you have the rate difference in these other 20, in the other 19 states that are mentioned in Mr. Bach's testimony. And my question is, and forgive me, normally I let the whole panel go, but I just can't resist this question.
are you claiming in this testimony that the 526% rate difference between Nevada's workers' compensation rates and Oregon's is directly and solely attributable to the fact that they have a cancer presumption language in their statute?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the four states that are identified in that chart do have a presumption, and the burden of proof obviously then is upon the employer to prove.
Thank you.
With respect to your question regarding is it solely
yes.
due to it, I can't tell you for certain. I would assume not.
Thank you.
Everybody's else's workers' comp systems are different. We picked the four states that we felt similar, based upon what was in Senate Bill 560 originally, the four states that had something similar to that with respect to their presumption, took their NCCI rates and inserted it in, and then did the we took the firefighter payroll and did the calculations.
Thank you very much. Go ahead, sir.
Thank you. Mr. Bach testified, he described the LeMasters report as being the strictest of its kind. And what LeMasters does in the meta-analysis is look at all the various epidemiological studies and comes to the conclusion that there's this likelihood of the three cancers that are enumerated in that study. This statute adds four more. The result of that is that in this unsettled law, unsettled area of medical evidence, there will be, in essence, a conclusive presumption that these kinds of cancers will always be related to work, even if they're in fact not. Because you can come up with scenarios where, for example, tobacco use, as Representative Rosenbaum brought up, may actually be the predominant, in fact, the 99.99% contributing factor to a certain kind of cancer. And for that reason, I think that the state of Washington has come up with a good compromise as to the various ways to look at how to process the presumption. They have a rebuttable presumption as well, which is really a rebuttable presumption. Unlike Oregon, where the employer has to show by clear and convincing evidence, Washington has a preponderance of medical evidence. And unlike Oregon, Washington also talks about different factors that should or have to be taken into account, one of which is tobacco use. Oregon Court of Appeals cases have wrestled with tobacco use with workers' compensation claimants and have basically said, you know, if there's any contribution by firefighting activities, then that's enough. A scintilla is enough. So we're proposing that a more reasonable way to look at the statute would be to include things like tobacco, to exclude tobacco smokers. The Washington statute also provides a tail. It cuts off liability after a certain period of time. They actually put a formula into the statute, which says basically after retirement is achieved, for a limited period of time after that, the fireman's presumption still applies. After that, it's back to basic workers' compensation law. We think that that's a fair and reasonable way to proceed in Oregon.
Sir, can you give us an idea of what window that time window would be after retirement?
Well, the state of Washington statute says no more than 60 months after retirement. They actually have a formula that says for every year of service as a firefighter, and this is a firefighter across the state, you get 3 months of additional coverage after retirement, but no more, notwithstanding the number of years of your service, no more than 60 months.
Thank you.
We think that's a reasonable way to look at the presumption with retirees, because at least with men, if we all live long enough, there's going to be certain kinds of cancers that are almost always going to happen. And we'll hopefully be in our 80s or 90s when that happens. But if it's enumerated here, and you've been a firefighter, and you've gone through the 5 years, and you've done the physical examination, you can actually make that claim. And under this irrebuttable presumption, as we're referencing it as, it's compensable. So what we propose is a reasonable way to deal with the fireman's presumption is that you take into account the tobacco use, you limit the tail, in other words, provide a cutoff over time, take into account pre-existing conditions, change the burden of proof from clear and convincing to preponderance of the evidence, and allow the system to work relative to a case-to-case basis as opposed to a broad brushstroke issue of compensability. And address the issue of the city of Portland essentially opting out of lifetime benefits.
Okay, sir, go ahead.
I'm Chair Schaffler, members of the committee. My name is Frank Stratton. I'm the Insurance Services Program Manager for the Special Districts Association of Oregon. I've been doing the underwriting of our workers' compensation self-insured program for the last 17 years. And our program is a completely self-insured program. As Ms. Squire said, we started the program back in 1988 when fire districts virtually could not get workers' compensation coverage, even from the state insurance program. And it's been extremely successful. So every dollar that we collect belongs to the fire districts. It's their assets. And those monies, if they exceed what we need to collect, is returned to them. It's my job as an underwriter to decide and make a statistical guess how much money do we need to collect each year. And so that has to be a pretty conservative assumption, and I have to make a guess that's going to be certain that I'm going to protect the assets of the public entities that are all self-insured in this program. And that's why in our fiscal impact statement, looking at the data in several different ways, along with in conjunction with City County Insurance Services, which is also the self-insured program that represents most of the city firefighters in the state. That's why we've come up with a rate estimate up to a 350% increase. We believe, looking at our health insurance data, and our health insurance program, we have right now five firefighters that have cancer. Looking at those claims, at least two of those would be compensable, we believe, under this law. We only have 54 fire districts in our health insurance program. There's 185 fire districts in our workers' compensation program. So I think taking that, even a conservative assumption on my part, when I look at that, and again, I have to make a conservative assumption, I think that you could easily have four cancers a year into the workers' compensation program. Looking at our data, as well as City County Insurance Services, that number on a per cost, per claim basis is easily $1 million a year. Not $1 million a year, I'm sorry, $1 million a claim, because you not only have the medical, but you have the lifetime disability, medical payments, et cetera. So, again, when I apply that, I think that we're not exaggerating. I think that if this bill was to pass as written, that's what we would have to charge in order to make it work. I think that's what City County Insurance Services would have to charge. I can't speak for any other insurance carrier in the state, but as far as a self-insured program, that's what it would be. There has been information, I think you have, that the NCCI, the National Council of Compensation Insurers, provided an analysis to the state that they show that the rate increase would only be anywhere from, I believe, 15 to 30%. One thing I wanted to make clear to you is that because Oregon is unique, and we've been lucky enough, I believe, to have the public entities in Oregon virtually self-insured, 90% of all the firefighters in the state are in self-insured programs. City of Portland is a self-insured program. Ours is a self-insured program, CIS. NCCI does not accept data from self-insured programs. So none of our programs, 90% of the firefighter data in Oregon does not get submitted to NCCI. Therefore, they have no statistical base of information to work from in making that analysis.
Thank you. Any questions? These nice people.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Thanks. I just had one clarification. I'm sorry I didn't catch your name, but the attorney who testified. Because Oregon has a presumption in law for firefighters right now for heart disease and certain other conditions, and your testimony is that this presumption creates a new non-rebuttable standard, and my reading is that the language that you're talking about is the existing law for the presumptions that we have already, and this just parallels exactly what the law is right now. It's not setting a new or more lax standard, so I'd like you to respond to that. And also, you know, Oregon has actually one of the toughest compensability standards in the nation, which was created, as Ms. Squires probably remembers, in 1990 when we passed the legislation on workers' comp in the special session, and that includes a major contributing cause standard for all claims that these claims will still have to prove that the job exposure is the major contributing cause. So I guess I fail to see how we're somehow throwing away the
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rosenbaum.
Kingdom here.
My statement was premised on the fact that there is the rebuttable presumption under the fireman's statute, as you've referenced. The problem is that there's a difference between medical evidence, which is settled, and medical evidence, which is unsettled. In areas where the medical evidence, scientific evidence, if you will, is settled, and there's no disagreement, the rebuttable presumption actually works. In the area of cancers, however, it doesn't work because there is always some scientific study out there that will say that a certain kind of cancer is somehow related to firefighting activities. The LeMasters meta-analysis is the perfect example because it wasn't unanimous as to what cancers were actually related to work and which weren't related to firefighting activities. There was a dispute, and that's why they talked about the three cancers that they thought which was more likely and the rest that they thought wasn't. So in the area of unsettled science, the rebuttable presumption really becomes a conclusive presumption of compensability because there will always be medical evidence saying that it is in some way related to work. I think your second point was kind of the strict compensability standards in Oregon. The rebuttable presumption is alive and well in Oregon under the firefighter's presumption. The employer has the burden of proof in that regard. The other portions of the statute, of course, the opposite is true. It's the employee that bears the burden of proof. So we're not suggesting that the rebuttable presumption go away. We want to actually take it from, in those areas of unsettled scientific law, from the conclusive presumption of compensability back to what it was originally intended as something that can be rebutted. Because, again, I don't know that there's any other state out there that has the language found on line 25, page 3, that says that the employer has to prove that the condition being claimed is unrelated to those firefighting activities. In other words, the employer has to prove a negative.
But follow up, Mr. Yes, Chair. Please. I guess my question is just that is the standard that's existed in Oregon law since the 1960s for presumptive conditions. So it's not a new standard. That is how our law has operated, and nobody, to my knowledge, attempted to change that either in 1990 or in 1995 when we had massive rewrites of our workers' comp law. So apparently it's been working for the conditions that we have presumptions for right now.
Right, and the change, I think, is because of the addition of the cancer, the different cancers, because in that area of unsettled law, all of a sudden, in essence, the employer will never be able to prove by clear and convincing evidence that the claimed cancer is unrelated to work because there's always some contribution based upon even the LeMasters report.
Well, I guess we'll agree to disagree on this one.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is the standard now that the employee has to prove currently?
Employer, Representative Edwards. Under the rebuttable presumption?
No, currently.
Current law outside of the fireman's presumption?
No. Currently, if from some of the examples we heard earlier, firefighter gets non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and they claim that they have to, the burden of proof is on them to prove that it was because of exposure, on the job exposure, correct?
Correct.
And the burden of proof is clear and convincing, or is it preponderance?
Preponderance of medical evidence.
Okay. That's all I want to know.
Any further questions?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'd like to call Ken Armstrong and Scott Wendell. Does anybody else want to testify here today, too? Because we're not working overtime.
Okay. I want my break.
Gentlemen, whoever wants to go first.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Ken Armstrong, representing the Oregon Fire Chiefs Association.
And let me stop before everybody clears the room. Today's Kristen's birthday, and we all want to wish her a happy birthday.
Happy birthday.
God bless her.
What a fun place to be. Yeah.
Add a little happiness into the room here.
Working overtime.
Okay. Okay, Ken, go ahead.
It's always nice, Mr. Chair, to sit before a smiling committee, so I appreciate that. Thank you. Realizing the overtime, I will be brief. I think it's no secret that the Fire Chiefs Association have wanted to see some bill get passed this session that deals with providing coverage for cancer for those firefighters that legitimately get it as a result of their service as a firefighter. As you heard today, you know, we're not there yet on Senate Bill 560. We think that the bill as written is way too broad. We don't really know what the impacts are going to be. I think that it's clear from the previous testimony that there is definite disputes over the science. There is definite disputes over what the impact on the workers' comp system is going to be. Those are of concern to the fire chiefs. That is why earlier, when it was over on the Senate side, we requested amendments that were going to limit it to three cancers. Those are the three that Ms. Squires talked about. They're in the probable category in the LeMasters analysis. We'd be willing to even talk a little bit further than that if we were able to really get drilled down on these sideboards, the notion of excluding smokers, having the tail on it. Maybe it's 5 years, 10 years, whatever, after a person's done with their service as a firefighter, that they don't have the ability to then come back. If you're an 80-year-old retired firefighter and has prostate cancer, would be able to come back and say, I got that as a result of my employment. So we've got some real concerns about that. The way this is trending right now, frankly, concerns us. I think what we have brewing is another fight like we had on collective bargaining. I don't think anybody wants to have that same thing. I think we need to get very quickly to a place of getting some compromise on this, and we are running out of time. I do not believe that what came out of the MLAC represents any sort of a compromise. I think that what we saw there was three hearings of the MLAC to develop a version of the bill that was going to be able to get the management representatives on that to vote yes, and it punted to the legislature, frankly. The positions that were stated by management interests were not reflected in the version that came out of MLAC. I do not think that that represents a compromise position. I think that maybe still ability to get there. Right now, it's looking a lot more dim. So, with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. We stand ready to help.
Go ahead, sir.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Scott Winkles representing the League of Oregon Cities. I would like to say, in regards to 404, good bill should pass. This was a consensus piece of legislation. We find it to be perfectly reasonable as written. As to the A3 amendments, the League is in staunch opposition to this measure. We do not believe it is scientifically justified, and we would point out to the fact that there is a distinct lack of Oregon or Northwest specific data to support it. What geographically relevant studies we have found, I was able to locate, do not have indicated that there's not a significant risk for most of these cancers. I would point to a few. Paul Demers et al., a 1993 study published in Cancers and Cancer Cause and Prevention, 1994. Multiple myeloma, they observed 2.2 cases and were expecting 2.8 in a study of 2,000 firefighters, over 2,000 firefighters. In brain cancers, they expected 3.6 cases. They observed 4. Prostate cancer, they observed 66 cases, expected 48.3, which is much higher. But if you compare that to police officers who are of the same socioeconomic background, same age, same physical stature, physical conditioning, and access to health care, it's not significantly distinctive. I'd also like to add, given this disparity in the scientific data, the cost increases are not justified. As Ms. Squires pointed out, the League of Oregon Cities, or City County Insurance Services, does not report to NCCI. We're the second largest pool of firefighters. SDAO does not report to NCCI, and the large self-insured employers in the state do not report to NCCI. I have no way of, I wouldn't even hypothesize as to how they came up with the number of 15% to 30% increase in workers' comp claims. What we've anticipated based on past experience is that each claim under this bill would cost CIS $1.1 million. That would represent, for one claim, that would represent approximately 220% increase in workers' comp rates. If the actuary, who decides how much money we have to reserve for potential claims, decides we'll get more, then we'll have to raise accordingly. So if he says we get four claims, we take that 222% number and multiply it by four. It's unknown, but we do know it will be significant. For the self-insured employers, such as Eugene or Gresham, they would be on the hook for the $500,000 plus. Then the reinsurer would kick over, provided they could find someone to carry the policies, which is a major concern for us. So we have offered some substitute amendments in the form of the Dash 11s for 560 that address the three cancers with the preponderance of the evidence standard. We feel this is reasonable, and with that, I'd be open to any questions.
Any questions of these nice gentlemen? Thank you, gentlemen. Would anyone, once again, anyone else want to testify this bill today? Seeing no one, I'm going to close the hearing on Senate Bill 404. And anything for the good of the order?
Are we going to hear the other bill or 680?
No, actually,
we're adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you.